The group's efforts dragged many into the blacklist. In 1954, screenwriter Lewis Pollack, a man without any known political views or associations, suddenly had his career yanked out from under him because the American Legion confused him with Lewis Pollack, a California clothier who had refused to cooperate with the HUAC. Orson Bean recalled that he had briefly been placed on the blacklist after dating a member of the party, despite his own politics being conservative. The names wouldn't be familiar to most filmgoers today. Herbert J. Biberman, Lester Cole, John Howard Lawson, Adrian Scott, and others. But in the 1950s, they were front page news. All were among the Hollywood 10 who were caught up in the notorious Hollywood blacklist. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. The blacklist set actor against actor and involved a lot of players whose names are household words, including Walt Disney, Ronald Reagan, Kirk Douglas, Humphrey Bogart, and Lauren Bacall. The stakes were high. Entire careers were on the line. And for some, prison sentences were a possibility. We're going to find out how the Hollywood blacklist developed, who was on it, and how it looks with a perspective of 60 or 70 years. With me is Jeff Smith, professor of film at UW-Madison and author of Film Criticism, The Cold War and the Blacklist, Reading the Hollywood Reds. Welcome to University of the Air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This is such a huge topic, as it turns out. You know, you pull on one little part of it and all kinds of other things turn out to be connected. Really, this fear of Reds, of communists, goes all the way back at least 100 years from our perspective. But if we look where, in the 1930s or 40s, do we start to see the genesis of the Hollywood blacklist?
We certainly do. I think the interest in the role of communists in the entertainment industries can really be charted from the late 1930s. Where, in fact, the Federal Theater Project had become a target of HUAC interest in May of 1938. And they were targeted in part because they were a government-funded group, because they were part of the Works Progress Administration. They weren't a huge part of the budget, but in predicting the kind of things we see even with today's culture wars, they symbolized something that seemed to concern conservatives in the 1930s. And so Martin Dies, who was chair at the time of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, insisted on having the Federal Theater Project manager, Hallie Flanagan, testify. And the big concern in many ways was that they were putting on plays, not even the majority of plays that were put on, but enough, around 80 or so, that were thought to be promoting what were leftist causes in terms of labor activism, the fight for racial equality, and subjects of that nature. And so Flanagan herself was questioned, and within less than a year, basically all of the funding for the Federal Theater Project was simply canceled.
And this was still during FDR's administration, the administration under which that project had developed.
Yes. In fact, for anybody who is interested, there is a kind of wonderful film that was made in the 1990s that's directed by Tim Robbins that really dramatizes one of the most controversial productions that the Federal Theater Project would put on. It involved Orson Welles, it involved John Houseman, it involved the songwriter Mark Blitzstein. And the name of the film is Cradle Will Rock, and it's about the kind of failure of that production to ultimately get off the ground under the auspices of the Federal Theater Project. The funding for it was pulled like 4 days before its premiere, and instead, they still filled the house with people and put on a show. It just wasn't staged. It was just kind of all the musical numbers were performed. They were even inviting people in off the street to pack the house for free. And it became a bit of a cause celeb, and certainly an important reason why Wells would later be targeted by the committee later on in his career.
Well, Wells was certainly not one to shy away from controversy and innovation. And so, I mean, with Citizen Kane behind him in 1941, I can see where he would be a high-profile target for people with a certain way of thinking. But was the concern really about what we might call liberalism, or was it about communism and a communism that would be controlled from Moscow?
Well, I think, to be fair, certainly the articulated mission of the committee was to look at political extremes on both sides. And HUAC initially began with an eye toward investigating the threat of fascism, and particularly kind of American versions of the Nazi Party in the U.S. And late in the 1930s, could say that to some degree this coincides with other very high-profile international events, the Non-Aggression Pact, which I think a lot of people could see coming and which essentially estranged a lot of people who would later on be seen as fellow travelers, because to see the Soviet Union more or less embracing their mortal enemy in Nazi Germany didn't sit well. And so the committee's interest was certainly to look at extremes on both sides. But the one thing that makes this sort of a difficult issue to kind of parse out in some ways is that it's also the case that you have a broader movement, the Popular Front, which was seen as a coalition of liberals, socialists, and communists across the left side of the political divide, and as an international movement, which certainly had its share of successes in Spain and France before giving way to totalitarian regimes in both instances.
I suppose the most tangible way of identifying people in Hollywood or in the arts in general as communists would be party membership. And now I would guess that some of those people were in the Communist Party until that very same non-aggression pact that you just mentioned between the Soviet Union and Germany.
Yes. And in fact, it's one of the things that the Hoover FBI certainly had no compunction about. There's even some suggestions by historians that the FBI, in fact, broke in at times to the Hollywood Communist Party office simply because they could then document all of the people who had party cards at any point in the party's history as part of the Hollywood chapter. So that was definitely the mark that would brand the unfriendly witnesses in a way that differentiated them from, say, the Committee for the First Amendment, many of whom were kind of targets of the investigation early on, but because they had no Communist Party membership, they were really just seen as fellow travelers, as pinkos, as kind of, you know, or the term that I particularly love is that they were prematurely anti-fascist, you know.
Prematurely.
such a strange term. It's like, at what point was it okay to be fascist, you know, as opposed to, you know, anti-fascist? And you know, anybody who really supported a Popular Front cause would come under a kind of shadow of suspicion. If you, you know, donated for an ambulance as a kind of humanitarian gesture, and that ambulance went to the Spanish Civil War, chances are you would be a target of HUAC just based on that kind of gesture. But it's certainly the case that when it comes to the 1947 hearings, which were held in Washington and which were very much a kind of public spectacle, the the investigators, and this is the kind of chief counsel for HUAC, Robert Stripling, he had in hand copies of those party membership cards for all of the 11 witnesses that were called. That really wasn't the issue for those who were called. They tried to counter the inquiry by insisting on their First Amendment rights, and that's because legally they didn't really have a defense to support them in the charge that they were kind of members of the Communist Party.
You would think they would start at least with the Fifth Amendment and not having to incriminate themselves, but they seem to have switched it over to the First.
Yes, and that was part of a sort of contentious legal strategy. The very simple formula that we have in this country is, yes, you are entitled to Fifth Amendment protections, the right against self-incrimination. But there were problems with making that a defense. One of them was simply that you look guilty. You know, it's always the case that, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, a witness takes the Fifth Amendment. You know, we very well may see that in the coming days with the, you know, investigation of the January 6th insurrection. I mean, it's kind of uncanny how much the kind of politics that surround that echo the HUAC hearings, because we have the prospect of contempt citations being issued. We have the prospect of witnesses who refuse to comply going to jail. And all of those things happened as a result of the 1947 hearings of communists in Hollywood. It's every time, you know, I hear pundits talking on any of the news channels about, you know, well, can they make these charges stick? And it's like, yeah, they can. we know that people went to jail for contempt of Congress throughout the 1940s and 50s because they refused to cooperate with HUAC.
Well, what was HUAC actually asking for that these people felt they couldn't deliver?
Well, it was a very simple question. Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And that was a question that they did not want to answer by taking the Fifth, because if you say, I once was a member, I no longer am, you potentially risked prosecution under the Smith Act. And this is one of those things that it was a little bit fuzzy back in the 1940s. But the Smith Act was something which was passed as a kind of security measure, which was designed to prosecute any group or individual who advocated political revolution. And many members of the Communist Party leadership were prosecuted according to Smith Act violations basically about 9 months or so after the 1947 HUAC hearings were conducted. The Smith Act prosecutions were in New York. It was basically the entire party leadership rounded up from their kind of 12th Street office, brought downtown and charged with Smith Act violations, because simply being a member of the Communist Party meant you sought the violent overthrow of the U.S. government. And because that was kind of seen as official Communist Party policy, it was very difficult to argue against, even as individual members would get on the stand and say, I have no desire to see the, you know, duly constituted government that is protected by law overthrown. I believe that change can be made through the ballot box, through the normal channels of legislation. Even if you said that, the counter to that kind of profession of loyalty to the U.S. political system didn't hold water, because the prosecutors then turned around and said, well, but we know from the Russian Revolution and the writings of Vladimir Lenin that the earliest communists used Aesopian language to evade the censorship of the Tsar. These people, you cannot trust them. They're simply using a line of argument that constitutes Aesopian language, and they're not being forthright or truthful about what their real intentions are.
So the Hollywood 10, how many of them then actually did have demonstrable affiliations with the Communist Party?
Oh, I believe it was all 10. What is interesting, of course, is that you had 19 individuals working in Hollywood, typically screenwriters, directors, producers, one actor, Larry Parks, and he was clearly a member as well. But only 10 were called because 11 were called. They're the Hollywood 10 that you mentioned, but Bertolt Brecht also testified. But once his testimony was over, he got on a plane immediately to, you know, East Germany and said, you know, to heck with this. I'm not going to deal with Hollywood anymore. And so that left another 8 individuals who had been subpoenaed. But once J. Parnell Thomas realized, as chair of the committee, that nobody was prepared to answer that one question, they all were trying to find ways of talking around it. He realized that this was just kind of fruitless and not worth giving them the kind of forum to claim that their rights are being violated by the inquiry itself.
Well, it obviously got a lot bigger. And how did that come about?
Well, if I can just, before we get to that, one of the things that's particularly striking is some of those 8 members who were certainly suspected of being communists and, in fact, would eventually be caught up in later hearings that would take place in the 1950s. And they actually went back to fairly flourishing careers before the return of HUAC to Hollywood in the 1950s. So you have this weird kind of interregnum when the hearings conclude, where the 10 are all prosecuted for contempt of Congress. They all end up going to jail. You have the studio executives getting together at the Waldorf Hotel about a month after the hearings conclude, and they issue a statement where they say, we will not knowingly employ any member of the Communist Party. And at this point, they're really kind of just shifting toward damage control. But that crucial thing is knowingly. You know, they all knew that the director and writer, Robert Rosen, you know, had been one of the 19 unfriendlies who had been subpoenaed. But he goes on to make All the King's Men and wins a Best Picture Award for it.
That's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
These guys, a lot of them, are really good at what they do.
Really good at what they do. And this is one of the things, is they didn't want to give up on real talent just because someone may have once been a member of the party. And certainly, Rosen had grown disaffected with the party by 1948, 1949. And in fact, he would become a cooperative witness in the 1950s.
Testifying against others who had been in the party or seemed to have leanings.
Yes, absolutely. Being in the position of having to, as they say, name names. So it's interesting that people were able to kind of continue their careers, even though in some ways their politics really in many cases had not changed one whit. It was really just kind of public relations damage control that instituted the blacklist in the first place.
Well, let's look at how it actually took off then and really became, for a time, an obsession in Hollywood when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Jeff Smith, and we're finding out about the Hollywood blacklist, which did include House Un-American Activities Committee hearings in 1947 in particular, and then there was this kind of hiatus while not a lot happened, and things come back in the 1950s. Before we get too much into the 50s, though, Jeff, let's just look, if we can, at a few figures, names that will be very recognizable, and how they responded to this whole situation, this question, are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Sure. I was going to say a little bit earlier that there was one person who seemed clearly not to be a member of the Communist Party, but was called and subpoenaed as an unfriendly witness anyway. And that was the screenwriter Howard Koch, who was famous for having scripted the War of the Worlds broadcast that Orson Welles had done at Mercury Radio Theater of the Air. He had also written Casablanca, A Letter from an Unknown Woman. He had written some great films. But he was really targeted more than anything else, I think, because he had scripted Mission to Moscow, which was a film that Roosevelt had personally invited Jack Warner to make at Warner Brothers. It was based on the memoir of the ambassador to the Soviet Union who served in the 1930s, Joseph Davies, who is, in fact, originally from Wisconsin. And yet it's a very kind of sanitized version of what life was like in the Soviet Union. It sort of whitewashes the purge trials, for example. And even leftists in the U.S. were writing letters to the New York Times saying, you know, what a kind of desecration of the historical record Mission to Moscow was. But it was a sanitized version in part because Davies himself seemed to offer fairly glowing reports of his interactions with party functionaries. He really didn't spend a lot of time meeting with Stalin. But one of the great stories about Mission to Moscow as well is that they had arranged a special screening of the film for Joseph Stalin to personally inspect before it went out into the world. And the report is that Stalin was so bored by it that he kind of stepped out to have a couple of smokes and then came back. And this is a man who is famously, he loved movies. You know, he, you know, a lot of the kind of Soviet musicals that were produced in the early 1930s were things that he adored. So, you know, it's interesting that even as propaganda, it didn't even kind of satisfy that mission. And yet, Jack Warner and Howard Koch were both targets of the investigation in some ways simply because they had been associated with the project.
Did Koch testify?
Koch did not testify. He had clearly prepared for testimony. We have his business papers in the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. And if you look through the kind of preparatory materials that he made, and I mean, there were similar kinds of documents for Dalton Trumbo and Albert Maltz, all of whom are part of the Hollywood 10 or Hollywood 19, as the case may be, and all of which are collections that we have in the center, which is a great, great, you know, research resource for anyone interested in the Hollywood blacklist. And it seemed clear that Koch, just looking at what he had put down on paper, he was maybe the one member of the 19 who was prepared to comply with the committee's question and simply deny ever having been a member of the Communist Party. And the sad thing is there doesn't seem to be any indication that he ever was a member of the Communist Party, and yet he ended up more or less being blacklisted anyway. After Letter from an Unknown Woman comes out in 1948, he doesn't have another screen credit until like the middle of the 1950s. And this is one of those kind of situations akin to what you had mentioned in your kind of introduction, is not only did you have a blacklist, but you had a gray list. In fact, people who were suspect, maybe never party members, but the studios more or less had to be cautious because there was always the chance that they might in fact be called to testify.
Walt Disney got involved. I suppose just about everybody did one way or the other. And that's what's interesting in particular, I think, today is how various people reacted to that kind of pressure. But Walt Disney, there was an animator's strike at one point, and he said, well, that's because there are communists in my organization that need to be purged, something to that effect?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. Disney's presence as a friendly witness at the hearings was completely motivated by the animator's strike, which he had endured, which was very contentious. It was less bloody, I suppose, than some of the strikes that took place in 1946, a year before the hearings, at, say, Warner Brothers. But he definitely blamed the Communist Party for, and labor organizers more generally, for having kind of whipped up the various below-the-line workers at the studio who just essentially went on strike and brought production to a halt.
Humphrey Bogart got involved too.
Yes, Bogart was a target of very early inquiry that Martin Dies had conducted back in August of 1940. So we're talking about 7 years, in fact, before the HUAC hearings of 47. And he was, in fact, brought into a kind of closed private meeting with the chairman of HUAC, Martin Dies, at the time. They'd kind of set up at the Biltmore Hotel. And he was among 18 Hollywood stars who, in testimony given at a separate trial, were implicated as being members of communist study groups or supporters of popular front causes. So there was no indication necessarily that they held party cards, but they were perceived as fellow travelers. And it wasn't just Bogart. It was Cagney. It was Frederick March, Melvin Douglas, Louise Rainer. And yet they were all cleared by Dies, who, after talking to them, came to realize, you know, that there may be smoke, but there ain't fire here. So the inquiry pretty much kind of ended. But what happened is, of course, Bogart and many other Hollywood liberals were active members of the Committee for the First Amendment. And in public statements, people like John Huston would say very openly, none of us here as members of the Committee for the First Amendment have any sympathy with communists. We simply are concerned about the violation of civil rights that this inquiry seems to have authorized.
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of way to get squished between the two sides, isn't it?
It is definitely a case that they got squished between the two sides. Because these were the, you know, none of the people who were testifying were big stars, but the big stars were all standing outside the hearing room, or in some cases in the hearing room, where they could be caught by the kind of newsreel cameras, making public statements in front of the Capitol. So Lauren Bacall, William Wyler, John Huston, and Bogart were all very public spokesmen that were basically challenging HUAC's authority. And there was just kind of political fallout from that, from movie fans. So during Katharine Hepburn, and she had been one of the Committee for First Amendment also, during a screening in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, people started throwing things at the screen of a Katharine Hepburn film because they kind of resented what they saw as her support for communists, even though they were trying as much as possible to kind of disassociate themselves from the witnesses and focus their energies on just challenging HUAC's authority. And Bogart got caught up in this as well, to the point that he basically in photoplay, worked with his publicist to create a story in which my guess is it was ghostwritten, but, you know, in which he says the title of it is I Am Not a Red, where he is overtly denying any involvement with the Communist Party because he had been tarnished in terms of his reputation by simply speaking out against HUAC.
So by the time we get into the 50s, who's left in Hollywood who can actually make movies?
Well, considering that, you know, only 10 individuals had been targeted by the Hollywood blacklist, there were still a lot of people up through 1951 who were very active in making films. But when the hearings restart on March 21st, the very first witness was Larry Parks. And Parks, you know, would have been a very attractive target for HUAC back in 1947. He had made this hugely successful film, the Al Jolson story. He was an actor. He was not someone who operated behind the scenes, you know, behind the camera as a director or in kind of the writer's room as a screenwriter. And yet he was not called to testify. But he becomes the first called to testify in 1951. And the new terms of how to engage with HUAC are set. Once it became clear that if you simply stand on your First Amendment rights, that's a very quick way to find yourself in jail. You'll be prosecuted for contempt of Congress. And if you wanted to avoid jail, you had to find another kind of legal strategy. So instead, the options became very stark. You could stand on your Fifth Amendment rights, but that was a way to lose your job. Anybody who refused to cooperate with the committee would be essentially seen as someone who was guilty of membership in the Communist Party. And the Waldorf Agreement more or less stipulated that, yes, your studio will fire you as a result of that.
I've got to ask. Go ahead.
I said, or you cooperate. But the problem with cooperating is you couldn't selectively invoke the Fifth Amendment. So let's say you're someone who is no longer a party member. You want to dissociate yourself from the party. The question comes, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? Yes, I was briefly a member in 1935. I spent 6 months with the party. I left it. Good riddance. I have no sympathy for anyone who believes in anything other than democracy. That would be a perfectly acceptable answer, except for one thing. Now you have admitted to the very thing that would be criminally liable. Fifth Amendment protections don't apply. And the very next question you're going to get is this. Who were the other members in your party cell at that time?
That makes it tough.
And that makes it tough. Because essentially, even if you wanted to admit that you were a member but not implicate others, that was not a legal option. So you're back to square one. You know, if you refuse to answer that question, you're going to be found in contempt and go to jail. Or you give up names. That was it. That was a very kind of stark choice that anybody who faced the committee was asked to do. And Parks himself begged the committee not to have to answer that question. He said, paraphrasing here, do you really expect me to crawl through the mud and inform on others? And that stigma of being an informer was something that Parks knew as he was answering that question. And of course, that stigma would cling to all of those individuals who ended up cooperating with the committee. And there we are talking about some very big names. I'd mentioned Robert Rawson, who had been an Oscar-winning director. Edward Dimitrik, who had been a member of the Hollywood 10 and did go to jail, partway through his sentence basically says, I've changed my mind. I want to cooperate. And he goes on to direct some of the most important films of the 1950s, like The Caine Mutiny. Later on, a Western called Warlock with Henry Fonda, Anthony Quinn, and Richard Widmark. So it was basically a situation where if you cooperated, you might regain your career, but you would never regain your honor.
Well, that's, yes, the other part of it, too. And I have to wonder then, what kind of movies are we seeing made in the 1950s under this cloud of, well, controversy and conviction?
Well, essentially, the kind of response to the committee when it came to movie making was to move kind of simultaneously in two separate directions. Hollywood realized that they had kind of a public relations disaster on their hands as a result of the hearings in 1947. The unfriendly witnesses were thought to be grandstanding. You know, in some cases, they had to be physically carried out of the courtroom. In other cases, they were just seen as being kind of snarky and uncooperative. And so the studios, this wasn't necessarily part of a plan, but almost all of the studios went to work on creating films that were kind of overtly anti-communist in their orientation. MGM, for example, went back into their vaults and reissued the Greta Garbo classic directed by Ernst Lubitsch, Ninotchka, because Ninotchka can easily be seen as a kind of anti-Soviet film. Ninotchka gives up her political beliefs because she meets Melvin Douglas and falls in love. You know, why not?
Very Hollywood.
Very Hollywood. So Ninotchka gets reissued within a few months after the hearings. The Iron Curtain, a very nifty kind of spy thriller with Gene Tierney and Dana Andrews, is released. And that's based on, you know, a real life case. You have other films that are based on kind of real life investigations of communists in the U.S., like Walk East on Beacon Street, which is done in the early 1950s. And every studio basically realizes that, well, one way we can satisfy the kind of public relations issues that HUAC has presented is to make films that really are responses to the kind of pro-Soviet films that we made as part of the war effort, Song of Russia, Mission to Moscow. We can make films that essentially come from a completely different part of the political landscape. And the downside to this was that these films, generally speaking, were not particularly well-reviewed, and they didn't make a lot of money. Some of them are better than others. Some of them are kind of interesting because of the ways in which they overlap with the kinds of tropes that you see in social problem films. So, for example, The Red Menace was a film that was kind of personally overseen by the head of Republic Pictures. And it was in many ways a kind of very interesting, kind of multifaceted view of the effect of the Communist Party on the lives of people who find themselves kind of drifting away from its strictures. And, you know, we have a kind of couple where someone is brought into the party, and this is a common trope. It was one that you mentioned in your intro that, you know, I met a girl, I fall in love, she happened to be a part of the party. You know, this idea that you're kind of seduced into the party through the allure of an attractive woman who becomes a party agent is something you certainly see in The Red Menace, where there's a kind of young Irish lass whose job seems to be to kind of meet men on the street, bring them into a party meeting, and hope that they will kind of become indoctrinated.
Well, let's look at another approach to this whole Hollywood response. It might be considered the other side of the coin, the films that relied on allegory to get a different kind of message across. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Jeff Smith, and we're talking about the Hollywood blacklists of the late 40s and well into the 1950s and how filmmakers responded to it in particular in this part of our conversation. We've seen some of them made hyper-patriotic anti-communist films. On the other hand, there were films produced that had a message that was more to the anti-communist side of things. One of the most famous, I wonder if it was recognized at the time, was High Noon.
It was, but the interesting thing is not in the U.S. It's one of the things that if you kind of trace the history of how people came to understand High Noon as a kind of anti-HUAC allegory, there was a Swedish scholar who had published a kind of interpretation of the film along those lines in 1955. And there is a Andre Bazin article about the super Western who just in passing kind of invokes High Noon as a kind of anti-McCarthy film. And yet, if you look at the reviews at the time, almost nobody mentions the fact that this has anything to do with communism or even Carl Foreman's involvement with the film as someone who was called to testify.
A very broad allegory. It's not, unless you say, what if it's about this, that everything would fall into place of the individual who's trying to call attention to this serious problem and nobody wants to recognize it, and so he has to take it on single-handedly, like, say, a Hollywood writer.
Right. And Foreman was someone who really saw the film as dealing with the issues around HUAC because it is a portrait of someone who stands up for the rights of the community but is abandoned by everybody else. So it was a film fundamentally about kind of moral cowardice.
Yes. It's all about cowardice, yes.
And in that sense, you know, you basically see Hadleyville, the principal town that is the setting for the film, and all of Sheriff Will Kane's efforts to go from person to person to person seeking assistance to stand up to this incursion from outside when Frank Miller and his cronies arrive on the noon train. And the fact that everybody kind of makes an excuse that, you know, he's even thrown out of the church, you know, all of these ways in which he's basically left as a man alone, you know, it was the, I'm sure, a way for Foreman to invoke or to represent the kind of emotional status of someone who's basically going in to face the community and without the perception of any support from the studios that are employing.
I'm guessing that Gary Cooper didn't see it as an allegory, maybe not Grace Kelly. I seem to recall, though, that Lloyd Bridges, who was also in the film, had trouble getting work for a number of years after that, and maybe some of the writers, too.
Yes, he did. Bridges was someone who ended up, as I recall, becoming a friendly witness. So so he was politically suspect, just as, you know, many others. And certainly he had appeared in some, you know, very kind of left-wing films. If you think about some of the films he made with Cy Enfield, who himself was a, you know, Communist Party member. You know, Bridges would have come under suspicion, I suppose, for that reason and would have been allied with people in that community. But Cooper, to his credit, even though he had been one of the friendly witnesses and had said, you know, things about not wanting to ever meet or have anything to do with any members of the Communist Party. He thought it was un-American. He really spoke out very forcefully against the beliefs of Communist Party members in Hollywood, he stood by Carl Foreman. And it's to his credit that he saw his professional relationship as something different than whatever politics may have divided them.
I can see on the waterfront as being more easily recognized as an anti-blacklist film because it's actually about somebody getting ratted out, isn't it?
It is about someone getting ratted out, but it's a film which has been prone to multiple interpretations because you have the kind of paradox of someone who is perhaps the most famous cooperative witness in Hollywood's history, Elia Kazan, and another cooperative witness, Bud Schulberg, who is the screenwriter for the film. The pair of them could easily be seen as making a kind of apologia with their reasons for, in fact, testifying. And yet, you're also right, it is kind of a film about a rat, that it's easy to see the film simultaneously as a film about someone having to stand up with moral courage to face down an oppressor. And so both of those readings of the film are things that you kind of see in the reception. But I would say probably the predominant is to see the film as kind of a rationale for cooperation. And that's largely just the, you know, force of Elia Kazan's personality, even though I think there are many films he made, like Man on a Tightrope, which plainly is kind of an anti-communist film. It's about Soviet censorship of a Czech circus where being ordered to stage clown routines that, you know, demonstrably condemn the evils of capitalism. I mean, it's such a strange scenario in some ways.
But nothing heavy-handed about that.
But yet the fact that you have this kind of humble circus owner who just says, I just want to make people laugh, going in and having to answer the charges of a kind of interrogation certainly looks like it's simultaneously a condemnation of what HUAC was up to as well. You may recall when he received the kind of career achievement Oscar in the 1990s, there were reaction shots of the audience with half of them clapping and half of them visibly sitting on their hands.
That kind of summarizes the whole thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does.
Before we go, I have to ask you about The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That's one that I don't recall thinking, ah, that's a message film.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers is interesting on several levels, in part because there was a kind of draft of the screenplay that had been done by someone who was by Richard Collins, who had been a cooperative witness, a member of the Communist Party who actually named the names of eight other members to basically get his career back. And it was produced by Walter Wanger, and Wanger himself had more or less had dealings with the committee as someone who was seen as, fellow traveler. He was not, to my knowledge, ever a Communist Party member, but his loyalties were suspect enough that he was, to some degree, a soft target of inquiry. And he gives a speech, in fact, in which he comes out, you know, very forthrightly against communism in the early 1950s, where he says, communists are taking over this country while we were sleeping. And man, if that isn't basically the scenario for Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where people are being replaced and finding themselves in this kind of completely harmonious community where nobody desires anything, all needs are met, and you just have to go along and conform. So in some ways, you know, the reading of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and certainly there are several articles out there that have applied this idea that it's a film about the threat of communist invasion seemingly coming over and taking over your town overnight. But there's also a sense of it as, yeah, and the same thing is true of HUAC, can scare the community into a sense of conformity. And that can happen almost overnight as well. So it also has this kind of bivalent quality that, depending on your frame of reference, you can see the pod people either being communists trying to subvert the community from within, or HUAC as this kind of outside force in which everybody is just going to look the other way and go along because that's how you survive in Hollywood in the midst of this kind of political struggle.
After 60, 70 years, what is the upshot of this whole Hollywood blacklist?
Well, it's been an issue which kind of resonates to this day. Both in the sense that Hollywood itself is a very politically divided community, and one in which some of the people who are, you know, donors to the Republican Party, not terribly open about their party affiliation because Hollywood itself is perceived as a very kind of left-wing community. A kind of activist where studio executives, people operating big production companies are making sizable donations to Democratic candidates in California for Congress, for governor, and, you know, in the presidential races as well. So that sense of a kind of split between liberals and conservatives within Hollywood is something which has continued and kind of has had its public fallout, where there's a certain segment of the body politic that just suspects Hollywood as being an entity which is largely devoted to promoting kind of left-wing causes. And you'll never convince them that no, these are businesses. They operate for profit. They do everything possible to make money. And the best way to make money is to avoid politics altogether. And yet, you know, you'll never convince convince the skeptical that that, in fact, is the case. But the other thing is you've seen a kind of historical rapprochement. The credits of people who had written scripts under pseudonyms or using fronts have gradually been restored. And that has been a process that began in the mid-1990s with the Screenwriters Guild doing kind of case-by-case reviews so that Dalton Trumbo's name gets put back on The Brave One, a film for which he won an Oscar, having written it under the name of Robert Rich, and which he could not claim for many, many years because the King Brothers, the production company that made the film, were targets of lawsuits saying, you know, I'm the real Robert Rich. And it took a long time for Trumbo to be recognized because he could not go public.
And well, let's leave it there for now, but look forward to talking some more Hollywood with you, Jeff Smith.
All right. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure, and I hope you can join me the next time around for University of the Air.